Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. South Africa in recession. The US Fed has cut interest rates by 50 basis points. It's huge. And that's in response to coronavirus. Real concerns about a slowdown in the global economy there. We'll talk about white-collar crime. We'll talk to Mike Brown, the chief executive of Nedbank. Nedbank finding itself at the wrong end of the recession. The man who made Frankie's drinks, remember him, Mike Schmidt from Balgowan in KwaZulu-Natal. Then he had his drinks appropriated by Woolworths. They still deny it to this day, but we all know. And so he got out of the drinks business, sold it to Clover. They've not done a great job with it, but what he's done now is gone and created a distillery in Hout Bay, and his gin, Navy Strength. I don't know why gin needs to be stronger than it already is, but they make a Navy Strength gin for sailors at 57% alcohol or something. It's been voted the best in the world. We'll catch up with him in a bit. Andy Rice with Heroes and Zeros. Then the Tourism Business Council on coronavirus. What plans can we make? How do we protect ourselves as we start seeing conferences in South Africa cancelled? And Tim Ferriss, who's a very popular conference speaker in the United States, has just pulled out of the South by Southwest conference in the US, saying he's not putting himself in danger. He's not expecting anyone else to put themselves in danger. The world is getting very, very scared about the invisible bug.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Two quarters of contraction in the economy equals recession. Gina Schoeman is Citibank economist, and she's on the line to us this evening. There's only one fact that matters here, whether it's a technical recession, a recession, something that feels like a recession, an environment that is recessionary, is that if the economy is not growing, none of us wants to spend, none of us wants to expand our enterprises, none of us, we all lose the will to live, Gina Schoeman, and that's what it feels like at the moment, I'm afraid.
Yes, hi Bruce, absolutely. I would say you hit the nail on the head. It's not so much about whether it's a technical recession or whether we got there by a couple of decimals or not. It's the mere fact that for 5 years in a row, this economy has grown below population growth. So for 5 years running, everyone has been getting poorer. And I think people feel that. And the spillover into the economy of that lack of confidence, the social unrest, the social frustration, I think we're starting to feel that too.
Yeah, it most certainly is, because without growth, the odds of improving people's lives are close to zero. And that's, I mean, we're 10.3 million people in South Africa who, even if they wanted to find a job, can't find a job. And you don't improve that without growth.
Absolutely. I mean, if we look back, you know, what's good about getting a Q4 print is that we can look back on a whole year and now a whole decade. And you see the extent of that deterioration year after year after year. The last decade we've just come out of is well below the averages of previous decades since being in a democracy. And I think 2019 just shows us people lost jobs. We had about 108,000 jobs lost. And the bottom line for me is that if we start looking across the economy, you see how broadly based the deterioration is. The tertiary sector, which is typically South Africa's darling, so the retail sales and your financial services, those are typical sectors that are quite resilient. They typically stay afloat and they help build quite a lot of growth momentum, or at least they used to. If you've had almost a decade of your primary and secondary sectors, so that's your mining and manufacturing and transport and construction, the longer those deteriorate for, well, the fewer services they will need themselves, plus the less income they're generating for consumers to spend, which are two channels that then feed back into your tertiary sector. So we need to be very careful here, because we really have lost growth momentum in this economy. And with this coronavirus floating around now for the cure, we risk falling into negative growth for 2020.
That's a real concern, of course, so much so that the US Fed today has taken an extraordinary step and almost looks like panic by cutting American interest rates by half a percentage point, by 50 basis points.
Yes, and absolutely. I think if you take that, the currency's response being stronger to that, almost as relief, the fact that our growth numbers are really coming in well below expectations. Plus, because growth is weak while inflation is going to be low, you put that all together, we have been expecting the SARB to cut twice this year, May and September. Timing's always tricky to work out here, but the risk is starting to build that we could very well get an earlier rate cut in South Africa. I think we need to watch what other emerging markets do very closely, and of course, how the markets respond to the coronavirus going forward over the next couple of weeks.
Gina Skuman, thank you. She is the Citibank economist on the line to us from Johannesburg. In studio with us, Mike Brown, chief executive of Nedbank. And these recessionary conditions, Mike Brown, are precisely the sorts of conditions that you have been operating in.
That's right. I think I said to you off air when we wrote our commentary that we put out this morning, we said recessionary-like conditions. We didn't know that the GDP number would print negative for Q4. We thought 0.3% for the full year, and we ended up at 0.2. But it's a really tough environment for our customers. We see our corporate customers' profits are under pressure. We see insolvencies increasing. And, you know, on the retail side, as Gina's just said, disposable income's under pressure, means people spend less and they have less money to repay their loans.
I mean, a 7% drop in profits, what does it reflect? I mean, it reflects all of these factors that you're talking about. And you've also seen for the first time, possibly since you've been CEO, a big sharp spike up in bad debts in corporate sector and in individual accounts as well.
Yeah, so I think if you look at the 7% drop we had in profitability, in the first instance, I think to say we were disappointed. We would have expected in this environment for earnings to be closer to flat year on year. So about 2% of that drop is attributable to hyperinflation accounting in Zimbabwe. Very complicated, but as inflation escalated dramatically in Zimbabwe to over 600%, we had to put our subsidiary on hyperinflation, and that cost us 2% of earnings. In 2018, that business made us 140 million rand, and in 2019, it made a loss of 110 million rand. So there's a 250 million rand swing year over year. The second thing we saw play out was a reduction in our private equity earnings. So in our private equity businesses, we buy minority stakes in other businesses that are trading in the South African economy. And as the economy is weaker and weaker, those businesses' underlying results aren't as good as they were last year. And because public market prices have fallen, when we value those businesses, we value them at lower multiples or higher discount rates. So there was a drop in our private equity income, which also cost us about 2% year on year in headline earnings terms. And then finally, the increase in bad debts, which was in our retail and business banking environment, more a cyclical increase in bad debts. We did have a poor collections experience in our motor finance business in December, but generally still a cyclical deterioration in retail. And in our CIB business, there were three exposures in particular that were already on our watch lists that we increased provisioning on in our year end. And that collectively cost us about 2-3% of earnings.
I mean, do we go back to an era where suddenly you become the owner of people's houses, where suddenly the properties in possession becomes a thing again because this economy contracts so aggressively that you're obliged to foreclose on houses and the housing market is dead? So it becomes a really difficult environment for that, for example.
Well, I certainly hope we don't get into that sort of environment. Our, you know, banks only buy in properties or properties in possession as an absolute last resort. And our properties in possession, either in our CIB business and RBB business, are at historic lows right now. We much more try and work with our clients in difficult circumstances, restructure the underlying loans, encourage our clients to sell the properties in a public market rather than through some sort of forced sale. So I do hope that we don't get to that sort of environment. I think what's interesting is that the last time we were in that environment would have been probably 2010, 2011, after the global financial crisis. And what's different this time is that in the build-up to the global financial crisis, bank lending was growing at 15% per annum. Mortgage lending was probably growing at 20% per annum. So there were a lot of bad loans being written at very high, you know, loan growth rates and high loan-to-value ratios. In the current environment, tough as it is, we've seen loan growth for the last 3 to 4 years at 5 or 6%.
Yeah.
So we've been much more disciplined in the credit environment than banks were in the late 2008, 2009.
Is demand for credit falling, or are you just being tougher in to the people to whom you extend credit?
It's probably demand for credit is relatively stable. And in terms of being tougher, we haven't dramatically changed our credit granting criteria over the last 2 years or so because, you know, we were forecasting a difficult economic environment. It's been more difficult than we thought, but it's not a surprise to us that the economy is where it is right now. So that was already built in to our credit granting models.
I mean, can you blame South Africans for feeling quite hopeless? The cost of living is rising, jobs are scarce, unemployment is at record levels, government is failing on many levels to do the basics of governing. We saw a budget last week that was probably the very best budget we could ever have dreamt of, but it does require a cut of 160 billion rand in spending on the public wage bill over the next 3 years. And certainly the union's response to that polite request so far has been quite obstructive.
Yeah, so, you know, it is incredibly difficult out there for all South Africans, and, you know, we can understand why people feel that they do. You know, I think it's the job of the leadership in South Africa, and that's the collective leadership of business, government, and labor, to point to a way out of these difficulties that we're in right now. And certainly the key thing to focus on remains Eskom and the supply and cost of electricity, because for so long as we have an interrupted electricity supply and ongoing load shedding at levels 1 and 2, it's very hard to see the economy growing at more than 1%. There's almost a cap in economic growth as a result of electricity supply. So, you know, what we really do hope is that this dire economic situation that we're in means that we can't kick the can down the road anymore on taking some of the tough decisions that need to be taken.
But certainly that was the tone of the budget speech. I mean, based on your experience of previous budgets and your experience in dealing with government, because you deal at a very high level with government, you go to lots of meetings, you have lots of discussions about the future and what the economy should be. Has this government got the political capital to push those much-needed reforms through? Because without those, it does feel like we're on a hiding to nothing.
Well, I certainly wouldn't pretend to know the answer to that, but what I do know is that without them, you know, what is already an unacceptable fiscal deficit and an unacceptable debt to GDP ratio becomes completely unacceptable. So I think we have very little choice but to push through with reforms, either on the expense side that we're talking right now, but I think we also need to focus very strongly on reforms that will boost economic growth, because over time, you can't save your way out of this problem. We have to get GDP growth back up to 2 to 3% levels, which even in itself is low.
And getting corporate South Africa to start spending and reinvesting in this economy. I mean, we see deals being done all the time, Bidvest is making acquisitions. We're seeing Spur growing slowly. We're seeing the ShopRite Group growing. They are expanding footprints. It isn't as if there is no economic activity in this economy. There is stuff happening. We just need more of it.
We absolutely need much more of it. And that's a function of leadership and confidence. You know, Larry Summers, his famous quote that, you know, confidence is the cheapest form of stimulus in any economy. And for so long as we continue to have policy debates around expropriation without compensation, policy debates around prescribed assets, around things like the national health insurance with no way of funding it, all of that saps confidence, which means we get less investment and less growth.
US Fed tonight cutting interest rates by 50 basis points. It's a big cut. It's a cut that suggests there is panic. Do you feel like there's panic in the world, coronavirus panic?
Yeah, there's very definitely an increase in risk globally. If we look back on 2019, you know, it was obviously a very difficult year for South Africa. We saw the GDP numbers, but we were helped by the fact that globally, actually, GDP growth was looking okay, so we were having a tough time down here in the southern tip of Africa, but globally there was a what we'd call a risk-on environment. Right now, you've seen global go into risk-off and South Africa in a tough space, so that's not a good combination to be.
Moody's?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we've got 27th of March and then perhaps later on in the year. I think it's 50-50 as to if we've done enough to give us a chance to later on in the year. Will they wait to see if we are able to get these public sector wage cuts through before they make their final decisions? Perhaps the only, you know, piece of positive news, if it is that you can take out of all of this is, you know, we've been debating Moody's downgrades for so long in South Africa that if you look at pretty much every financial market asset, it looks like downgrades are already in the price. So if there isn't one, that's a positive surprise as opposed to the other way around.
Mike Brown, Chief Executive of Nedbank. Thanks for coming in.
The Money Show.
The markets.
JSE went up 2%, despite the fact that we're in recession, despite the fact that there's lots of negative news about. So we did see that that extraordinary day on the JSE. I don't know whether it's going to continue tomorrow, because US markets, after responding very positively to that initial burst of adrenaline, the Red Bull-fueled burst of growth that we saw on US markets this evening, we saw that big announcement of the cut by the US Fed. Markets in the US have now moved into the red. They've lost all of that early enthusiasm and impetus. There's no pleasing markets, is there, Norman McKechnie from Momentum Asset Managers?
Bruce, it doesn't seem to be. It sort of seems to have taken quite a while for this whole virus issue to dawn on the markets in terms of what it's going to do to growth and obviously earnings. I think if one looks at the 10-year bond as the benchmark indicator, it's come off from probably 40-odd basis points, maybe even 50, from about 1.6 to about 1.1. And that's telling you that they are looking for a slowdown, no inflationary pressures. And it didn't respond when this 50 basis point cut came through. So, clearly, I think if one uses that, and I think it's the best benchmark out there, it's telling you that growth, in terms of what the outlook is, it's not great.
It certainly isn't. And in our context, if the world slows down to a grinding halt, well, then we've got another terrible year ahead.
Bruce, yeah, we probably have. I think, the other positives, if you do come to a grinding halt, you need to look at the oil inventories that are building up. China has obviously cut back. You can see from the traffic data that that's well below what it normally is this time of year. And you've seen the US inventories build up, so the oil price is going to come back. So that's the one positive. The other positive, with low interest rates, it tends to push gold up. We do produce gold, and then the shortage that we have in the whole palladium market. So if you look at our terms of trade, admittedly, if you look at what happened in terms of exports, agriculture, etc., in this last GDP number, not great. But the terms of trade might improve, and you might see the rand actually strengthen on the back of that. What we will see then is obviously inflation probably staying where it is, probably 4-odd%. And I think with the US cutting, we could see interest rate cuts coming through, and that's clearly will underpin the consumer. So that is one positive from this whole scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's the one positive, but the positive comes about as a result of a great big fat negative, and that negative is a world that is really, really scared right now, rightly or wrongly so. Nedbank came under pressure on the day, down 2% to 171 Rand. Mike Brown, chief executive, just in studio in that very seat where you are, just saying that they would have hoped to have had sort of flat earnings, but a couple of reasons as to why things went south. And one of those reasons is households and businesses are taking a lot of pain and struggling to pay back their debts.
I think that's right, Bruce. Certainly if you went to, I think it was his last slide in his presentation this afternoon, where they looked at the sort of growth, in fact, it was the penultimate slide, and they looked at the growth that they had anticipated 2 years ago, both for 19 and probably 18, and what came through in 20, the growth has been a lot lower, and clearly the consumer is a large part of the economy, and that did come under pressure. The other consequence of that was the impairment charge that went up 66%. And that literally wiped out, anything that they made in terms of increased net interest income and other revenue. So there were a number of write-offs that came through and did impact their earnings. But I think the big one there was the impairments. But clearly slow growth doesn't help you in that environment.
It certainly doesn't. You've only got to look around you to some of the big retailers, look at some of the big businesses in South Africa that are dependent on South African consumer spending. And it's hardly surprising that they are struggling. Financial sector has been under pressure recently. There was a bit of a recovery today. Commodity prices did all right. I mean, if you were a betting man, would you be betting for a positive year for South Africa in 2020 based on the fact that we are in recession? We've got this coronavirus bug, which is threatening to take over the world.
Well, I think, Bruce, though, my counter to that would be bull markets are born out of pessimism. And so when things really get bad, there are opportunities. And I think there are perhaps a number of opportunities out there. I think we probably will see some of the other banks reporting numbers that will disappoint, whether they disappoint to the same extent as Nedbank. I think a lot of the other banks have provisioned a lot higher than what we've seen with Nedbank. So theirs was really a catch-up sort of story. But yeah, I think if one looks at markets look to discount 12 to 18 months ahead. While things, I think, with the coronavirus, probably this quarter, next quarter, in terms of Chinese growth, commodity prices, et cetera, will be weak. Further out, I think we probably trough out. And then, so in other words, we're probably in for some headwinds in terms of equity performance in the short term. But further out, one's reasonably positive with interest rates coming through, et cetera. And I think we should see some recovery from the consumer. The consumer certainly has been under pressure. And there must be some pent-up demand that sits there.
We certainly hope so, Norman McKechnie. Here's with Momentum Asset Managers.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
Sport coming up in a moment. I see Twitter has told its staff around the world that they can work from home. And it's all, again, the fears of coronavirus. Twitter's already suspended all non-essential business travel and events, restricting visitors as part of its attempts to try and minimize the spread of the virus. It also says it's increasingly deep cleaning and sanitizing all of its offices and all of those who need to go to them. They should try sanitizing and deep cleaning their platform from time to time, quite frankly, as well. What they spread is as deadly and as dangerous and as toxic as coronavirus is to your body. What they do is that corrosive to your soul as well. On your next Money Show, the newly appointed Transnet Group Chief Executive, Portia Darby. She joins us in studio as this week's Shapeshifter. Really looking forward to that discussion. Also, Business Unusual with Colin Cullis. He'll look at how businesses can prepare for the cold season and how that might include COVID-19. On our Consumer Corner, we've got Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola. You can already see her. She's flexing. She's warming up her muscles. She's crunching her knuckles, preparing to fight for your consumer rights. Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
So often the focus on corruption and crime in the state-owned enterprises takes center stage. But today it's the turn of South Africa's private sector. The number of South African organizations that have experienced economic crime actually went down last year to levels last seen in 2011. That's the good news. The trouble is those that are committing crime still are greedier than ever before. The PwC Biennial Global Economic Crime Survey, the 7th South Africa edition, out today. And the cost of white-collar crime is rising. Trevor White is the partner at PwC Forensic Services. Are we seeing fewer crimes but of higher value, Trevor? And that's a concern.
Yes, Bruce, it is. And it's actually a very concerning statistic, because while the totals come down, the type of crime has become more sophisticated, and the level of the people that are involved in committing them as the primary perpetrators is moving more and more to the senior management of the organizations.
Is that a factor of economics? Is it a factor that a lot of these people are highly paid individuals who are heavily dependent on the performance of share prices to make sure that their share options are be able to cash in at very, very high profits? And so what they start doing, you know, early on in a negative cycle is they tell a fib, and then they tell a lie, and then they deceive, and then it becomes fraud very, very quickly after that. I mean, is that really the main factor of senior executive involvement, or some people just downright crooked?
Bruce, I think it's a combination of both. So I think in many instances it starts off where they think they can fill a small hole by doing something not quite right in one year. The next year doesn't go according to plan, and there's that hole to fill plus another bigger hole. And very quickly, it's not just wrong accounting. It becomes, as you say, it becomes fraud. And as a result, they get into the cycle. And what's happened now is with the economic downturn is the level and area to maneuver has become reduced. And as a result, things that may have been going on for 10 years in some instances are now suddenly starting to be exposed, because there's no room left to hide. And as a result, these people that in some instances are just plain greedy, but in other instances are just, it's all about an ego. They promise the market something, and they do whatever it takes to deliver that number, whether it's properly accounted for, whether it's just a made-up number.
So what we're seeing is lots of fraud being perpetrated, and we know of companies where these allegations are there. There's Tongaat, of course, there is Steinhoff, and there are a bunch of other companies where there have been allegations of very high-level fraud. But what is perhaps as concerning is the fact that, you know, so many of these frauds are being committed by people in middle management. It's almost like a training ground, perhaps, for future fraudsters. They're involved in procurement and things like that.
Bruce, it's not solely your senior management. The current survey says it's almost evenly split between senior management, middle management, and junior management or operational staff. And then the problem is once people are in a system, they're doing something incorrectly, over the years they get promoted, the opportunities to do bigger things more incorrectly just become available to them. So the problem is that once an organization, the culture ends up that people do things wrong, it becomes culturally acceptable within the organization, regardless of the level that you find yourself in.
And how important is culture in this discussion? Because often they say the fish rots from the head. And if management teams are perceived to be crooked, people within organizations are more likely to take risk when it comes to their own sort of extramural or extracurricular activities within the company.
But that's 100% correct. Because what happens then is the more junior people think, well, the boss is doing it. If I get caught, is he really going to expose me because I can expose him? And as a result, and it's the same whether it's the private sector or the public sector, if it's happening at the top, people down the bottom think it's an acceptable way of life, and they also think they've become immune to being called out on what they're doing for their own personal benefit.
Is it a breakdown in law and order generally? The perceived incapacity of the National Prosecuting Authority, the perceived incapacity of police to do their work, that emboldens people to behave like this is the Wild West?
Bruce, I think people, if they don't see that there's any consequence to them doing things that are just plain illegal, if there's no negative consequence to it, then people that mainly honest may think, well, I might as well take a chance because there's no downside to it. I think the issue is whether in the past, maybe 10 years or so, whether there was a will to prosecute people, and maybe there wasn't. Maybe petty crimes were, but the big crimes weren't prosecuted on a consistent manner. I think that's changing. I mean, I think the will has changed. The message is getting out there. And I think all that it's going to take is for the first few big cases where the ringleaders of these big economic crimes, whether they the private or the public sector, start to be arrested. I think that's when the message will start to stick home, that taking a chance is no longer really quite as lucrative or worthwhile as it has been in the past.
We used to believe that senior executives who were well paid wanted to preserve their reputations. They wanted to be seen to be superheroes. They wanted to be regarded, maybe their superhero was either Steve Jobs or Jack Welch, for example. They wanted to be seen as big and successful as those sorts of people. Now we find out that many of these guys have been willing to commit fraud in order for that semblance of authority to exist. How much of this issue of the expansion of white-collar crime is down to good old-fashioned ego?
Because I think a large portion of it is, but I mean, in all instances where it is to keep their ego intact, they ultimately always benefit as a result, because these are the people that have got the share options. They are heavily dependent in their remuneration structures on the success of the organization, on the share price, etc. So while the ego may be important to them, they're ultimately benefiting financially as well at the same time.
How do we eradicate this? How do we deal with the scourge? Because we've got a problem, a really serious problem when it comes to white-collar crime.
Well, Bruce, as I was saying, once the first people start getting arrested and they suddenly realize it's quite unpleasant sitting in court, and some of these trials will last for months on end. They're going to sit in court for 60 days in a row. They're going to be on TV every day, walking in and out of court. It's not a very pleasant situation to be in. Then all their friends at the golf clubs and everywhere else they socialize are going to start to say, You know, those are not the people we want to socialize with. We don't want to be seen to be their friends. And then once these senior executives start to be ostracized in social circles, which at the moment they're not because nobody's been arrested, then I think the message will start to change. It's also going to start to change when, and I think the message is starting to sink home. People we're talking to, they're starting to say, as non-executive directors, I'm very nervous to be on a board. I'm not sure what's actually happened. In the past, people were quite happy to accept the position. It was quite a prestigious thing to be on a number of boards. You didn't do much, but you got paid to go to a lot of meetings. But now it's starting to come with a lot of risk. And I think it looks like a number of these organizations are going to start to hold the non-executive directors that were there in the past, as well as the executive directors, personally responsible for some of these losses. And once that starts to happen, people are going to start to feel it in their pockets. And they're not going to just sit by and watch it happen without actually saying, if I'm on a board, I'm not going to allow this to happen. I want to know what's happening.
My thanks to you this evening. Trevor White, who is a partner of PwC Forensic Services, on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. A fascinating report into the mind of the corporate criminal, people who work at multiple levels within organizations, people who basically run organizations, who find themselves at the wrong end of the accounting practices of their firm. They start with a small lie and invariably it all comes collapsing down with a big lie. Ultimately, they do get caught out. Ultimately, people wise up. We've seen it happen countless times in South Africa. And for all of the ego massaging that huge corporate success brings, if it's not real, it is going to end. And when it ends, it's going to end in tears. You've been warned.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
South African drinks tend to do well globally. Mainstay won the world's best vodka a couple of years ago. Today, the guy who brought you Frankie's drinks has won a big accolade for the gin he produces. Mike Schmidt makes his gin at the Hout Bay Harbour Distillery. This was a particular one, Mike Schmidt. This is a Navy Strength gin. Since when did gin need to be stronger than gin already is?
Hi, Bruce. Well, there's always crazy stories around gin. You know, gin and rum were issued as alcohol rations sometime in the 16th century in the Royal Navy, and both were stored below decks together with the gunpowder. So to ensure that if they leaked out and soaked into the gunpowder, that the gunpowder would still light, the gin had to be 57.15%. or higher. So Navy Strength gin is 57.15% to 58%. It's a very, very strong gin. And, you know, the other interesting thing is most of the enlisted men drank rum, and only the officers actually got to drink the gin. So Navy Strength gin, that's what it's all about.
It's interesting in a world that is going lighter, the world that is going for lower calories, a world that is sort of not turning its back on alcohol, but is generally going for lower doses of the stuff, that there is a demand for these stronger drinks.
You know, it's a very specialised category, Navy Strength. A lot of the distillers stay away from it, although in this year's awards, there were some 48 Navy Strength gins from around the world entered. Some 450 gins in total from around the world entered into the World Gin Awards. So, first of all, to win best Navy Strength in the world was a huge accolade for our small distillery. But yeah, I think, you know, the nice thing about a Navy Strength gin is you get slightly more in one top than you get out of a normal gin. So that's some of the attraction. But yeah, it is true. You know, people are watching what they drink. But for us, we were only ever going to make two gins in our small distillery. And when it came to making our second gin, I looked around and saw what was being done with flavored gins and botanical gins. And I decided, you know, to have a go at making a Navy Strength gin in this very specialized category.
I mean, it's interesting because it's easy to be overpowered by the alcohol in higher strength gins. If you have some of the Belgian beers, you taste the alcohol. And for many of us, that's quite off-putting. I suppose the secret is to keep the kick, but to keep the fumes down, the overall overpowering sense of alcohol in the drink. And I think you achieve that in yours.
Yeah, listen, we've received fantastic feedback on our gin. I mean, the overwhelming consensus is that the gin is exceptionally smooth and you really don't know you're drinking a 57.15% alcohol, gin. And I think a lot of that goes down to the ingredients that we've used in the gin. And as I said to you, a lot of this going to stay away from Navy Strength for that very reason. I mean, you nailed it right there. You know, the ethanol that we use to make gin is not great. You know, it's not like a whiskey or a rum ethanol, which has some flavor. The alcohol, the ethanol actually has no flavor. It just has a strong, strong alcohol smell and taste. So you really need to put all that flavor in. And at 57%, you're leaving a lot of that ethanol in the bottle. So you really have to be sure that you've got the distillation correct and, of course, the ingredients correct.
We're standing out against 450 competitors at a competition like this. Does this open up a new market for you, a new series of markets for you?
Yeah, it's been very interesting. You know, we're still over in the UK talking to people about getting our gin into the international market, especially UK and Europe, essentially. And it does. It certainly does. You know, the decision to enter the World Gin Awards, which are the most prestigious awards in the world, they actually started at the World Spirit Awards, but the popularity of gin, gin has now got its own awards. Whiskey have a separate awards, and so on. This year was the highest entry in the award's seven-year history, with 450-some gins from around the world in a number of six or seven different categories. So, yeah, it certainly does. I think, you know, anybody, it was a chance we took. We felt really comfortable with the gin, but you never know. You know, you taste your own product and think, wow, this actually tastes quite good. But rather than enter a local one, because I think it's important that the local market is flooded with craft gins as it is, for small distilleries like ours to start looking for other markets. And the only way you're really going to do that is to take your gin and show it on the world stage and keep your fingers crossed, you know.
Well, Mike Schmidt, it worked. Founder of Frankie's Oldie Soft Drinks and the founder also of the Halk Bay Distillery. He's won himself a huge prize at a massive global gin competition. Well done to Mike Schmidt, who keeps making waves.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702. For the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africa Nacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. On this Tuesday evening, we are in recession. That came through loud and clear with the economy contracting again in the fourth quarter. And then on top of that, what we've seen the United States do tonight, the US Fed has cut interest rates aggressively by 50 basis points. And that is aggressive by US standards. They are very concerned about coronavirus and its possible impact on the US economy. And so they're acting to prevent a meltdown. What's been interesting about that is it came out after our market closed. By then, we were up 2% on the day, despite the bad news in the economy. I think the market had kind of anticipated that if we weren't in recession, we were so close that it really was negligible. What's interesting tonight is to see how much stronger the Rand has got on the day. At one point, we were around 2015 to the pound. We're at 1963, 1707 to the euro, 1529 to the dollar. If you watch these things, you'll realize that these are huge swings and roundabouts in terms of the currency. I saw the CEO of an organization today who was looking a little bit pale and drawn. And I said to him, are you worried about the coronavirus? No, my wife's going to London. That was bothering him. And not because she may get infected by coronavirus. That obviously would be a concern. But his concern, of course, was the exchange rate. Andy Rice this evening is here with our Heroes and Zeros. We'll pick up with him in just a second. We've also got Lee Kasumba, who's going to bring us our Africa Business Report. And then the Tourism Business Council this evening on what measures are being taken to protect tourism. It's probably the most vulnerable part of our economy to a threat of coronavirus. If people get frightened that they may get infected, they stop traveling. If they stop traveling, we don't get their money. If we don't get their money, the one industry in South Africa that we can ramp up fairly quickly doesn't get ramped up. I've got a line for you, Andy Rice. Now is the winter of our disinfectant. How's that?
There was another lovely pun on that same quote when a camping company had their annual sale, and it was, now is the discount of our winter tents.
Oh, that's better. Oh, okay, scratch that out. I was feeling very clever, very smug. Don't ever be clever with Andy. Be cleverer. Now, the Advertising Effectiveness Awards are gone.
Well, they haven't gone. They've taken on a new identity. So if you ask people, you know, why do we advertise, particularly financial directors and people like that, they will not be sure why we do it. They will continue to perpetuate the view that it can be a self-indulgent and expensive exercise just there for the amusement of the marketing people and their agencies. But, of course, the real value of marketing and advertising is to deliver commercial results. And that's always been not the saving grace of the industry, but it's always been the raison d'etre of the industry. If you can deliver results, commercial results, business results, hard-nosed results, then your marketing has been justified. And we had here in South Africa an excellent awards program that recognized effectiveness in marketing, effectiveness in brand communication, called APEX. And in my opinion, APEX was certainly one of the top two or three effectiveness awards programs in the world. Very rigorous, very diligently judged. Well, there's a global competitor, if you like, called the Effies. Effies as in efficacy, I suppose. And they are they operate their awards program for effectiveness in 50 countries around the world, a big brand, a big exercise, a very big database, and a very successful exercise. And now the decision has been taken because they wanted to come into the South African market, and it was decided that to carry on as a lone voice in the wilderness for APEX had no great advantage over rolling their equity in with the Effies Award. So as of this year's annual Effectiveness Awards, they will be branded Effies, not APEX. They are currently in preparation. The agencies and their clients are working as we speak on preparing their submissions, and that'll be judged in sometime in May. And then I think mid-year, July-ish, we hear the results of the first season of Effies for South Africa. It will give our agencies and their clients the opportunity to benchmark themselves against others. So it's not just an exercise in papering over any cracks. It really is giving us another place at the global advertising table.
Lovely. And South Africa's generally done very well in the world of advertising. So
that's
it's
right.
Nice to see that we can compare ourselves even better into the future. One of your, can I have a rant? Do you mind
if I rant? Of course. Please do.
Thank you. I know billboards are sometimes infuriating to you. You're a big fan of the medium of the billboard, the big, bold, simple, clear, the sort of advertising you can take up in an instant. I was driving down the M1 South today, and just after the Woodmead turn off, there is a billboard. And it's a billboard advertising the fact that you can get your license discs for your car online. Now, that's a good service, and that's lovely. But one, the billboard was cluttered with so much information, I couldn't read it all. And the other one fact was that it was so far to the right-hand side that it was actually over the north lane, but facing to the southbound traffic. So in order to see this billboard, you would need not to glance up at a billboard or glance slightly across, but take your eyes off the roadway completely and turn your head 30 degrees to your right in order to clock this billboard, by which time you've clocked it, you hate it because it's got too much information on it, and you go, ugh.
You've driven into the back of the vehicle
and
in front.
And you very nearly drive into the person in front of you had they slowed down suddenly for an emergency. It's a diabolical situation. You should go there and remove it immediately, Andy.
I will get my angle grinder and I'll be there on Wednesday morning. Actually, that leads nicely into I was going to be one, but I think I've even got two little stories about outdoor. Because I'm coming back from the airport today, I saw a billboard for the Mercedes X-Class, the Bucky, I think it's called an X-Class.
Yes, yes, I've seen that billboard, yes.
And it says, the first of a new kind, because they were trying to get the Mercedes luxury into the Bucky category. The trouble is they've just announced globally, worldwide, that the X-Class has been a failure and it's being discontinued. So it does rather tempt one to say, well, it may have been the first of a new kind, but it also sounds like it's the last of a new kind as well. But anyway, that's just an observation on creativity. I wanted to tell a little story about the customer experience, something we touched on a week or two back, and about the devil in the detail, that brands can be disproportionately influenced by small aspects of what they promise. And there I was just a week ago on a road trip from Cape Town to Johannesburg, taking the long way round and driving through the Free State around sort of Kroonstadt area. And what happens? But a traffic policewoman leaps out into the road in front of me and forces me to a stop. Now, I knew I hadn't been speeding because I had it on cruise control. But what I was worried about was the fact that as I pulled over, I realized that my license disc, as you have just been talking about, was still attached to the rest of the piece of paper it had come with. In other words, I hadn't cut out that round disc and stuck it onto the windscreen. I'd paid for it, but it hadn't displayed it. I knew that was an offence. But I had it with me. It was in the cubbyhole of the car.
But so at least it should be on the dashboard, so that when you open your car window, it gets blown out into the road.
the police officer comes to the car, and I go through all the usual pleasantries, and she wanders around, and she certainly, undoubtedly notices the absence of a valid disc, and comes back past the car, and I kind of rather feebly shout out, but I couldn't, I've got it, but I couldn't find a pair of scissors. And she, so she wanders off back to her car and rummages through her papers, clearly writing me out a ticket, and returns a few minutes later, and I realised that was a pathetic excuse I tried to pass myself off with. And she gets to the window and she says nothing other than producing a pair of scissors.
Oh, lovely.
No ticket, no nothing.
Oh,
waits
sweet.
While I cut out the disc from its mounted piece of paper, give the scissors back to her, and she waves me on and says, "Drive safely, sir." Wasn't that nice? Now, that's coming from a category of public servants whom we don't
yes.
always look at in the happiest of light.
But that's an extraordinarily high level of EQ. She had an option there to
yes.
fine you because you were against the rules.
Yep.
And 99% of the traffic cops that I grew up with avoiding in the Free State as a younger person would have gone, "Oh, got you, lekker."
Yes.
And she's just had the good sense to go, "You know what? You are a law-abiding sort. There is the disc. Yes, there's a technicality I could nail you on, but actually, let me help you."
So
well
that,
done.
Yes,
officer.
Wasn't it good? So one aspect of the police force now in my subconscious will always be a little more liked than it would otherwise have been.
Yeah, I mean, generally, I find the Metro cops are lovely people, wonderful people. Generally, very very nice. And then your zero.
My zero, right. Obviously, coronavirus has been in the news an enormous amount, and rightly so. But there is a brand of Mexican beer, a very successful global premium beer called Corona. How unfortunate.
And I showed you a billboard about...
Yes, you did indeed.
A month to 6 weeks ago, and I said, "Look what I got... at Durban Airport." Isn't that funny? Not Corona adds life. I think I've deleted it since then. But it was.
This is living.
Corona, this is living. And you went, "Oh, but people aren't going to be stupid enough to make that association." It turns out that people are not as bright as you think they are.
You're absolutely right. And anyone who responds in that way is on my list for zero status. So what the story that went around was as follows. And here's a headline from one of the business journals. "The maker of Corona beer has already lost sales of 4.3 billion rands to the coronavirus." And the clear assumption is that people are seeing a direct link between the virus and the beer and steering clear of the beer as a result. Having dug in a bit deeper...
There are so many other reasons to steer clear of that beer. You don't have to...
No, Bruce.
Okay.
What if you do dig a little deeper, you find that while there are no... undoubtedly some morons who do associate the two as coming from the same source and therefore to shun them both. The reality is that what the coronavirus has done is to change some of the dynamics of the beer consumption market. And what has happened in China in particular, where Corona was, probably still is, the number one premium beer brand, is that people have stopped socializing in big groups because they're worried about transmitting or receiving the virus. As a result, beer volumes are down generally. The Chinese New Year celebrations this year were down because of the virus. And being a premium beer, Corona is more likely to be the first to be dropped because if you're not socializing with friends who you want to impress, but you're just drinking at home, any old beer will do. So the reality is that the brand may have lost some sales, but it's for reasons of sort of a structural nature rather than a virus nature. And so I think anybody who's been perpetuating that story, whether it's the journalists or whether it's the people who've been drinking the beer themselves, are all collectively in my zero for the week. And I would just say that I have been doing my very best personally to offset some of the problems that Corona have been having with their volumes.
You are a true patriot. Andy Rice with Heroes and Girage.
The Africa Business Report.
And Lee Kasumba joins us this evening. She is the host of Africa State of Mind. Your first story this evening, Lee Kasumba, on the line to us from Johannesburg, is how the Somalis anticipate a recovery in Somalia. It may be a bit ambitious.
What's happened? Good evening, Bruce. So the finance minister of Somalia, his name is Abdirahim Duale Bailey. He has lived outside of Somalia for quite a while. As you know, for the last 2 to 3 decades, Somalia was declared a failed state by the international community. So since then, he's returned to Somalia, and part of his job has been to try and see if they can get like their debt reconciled, because currently Somalia has a debt of around $5.3 billion, which is owed to the World Bank, IMF, and other major organizations. So what's been happening is that he's been able to consolidate quite a bit of the debt. So for example, from the Paris Club creditors, he's managed to get them to cancel debt between 75% to 80%. The World Bank is also forgiving them quite a bit, and the IMF is set to follow suit. And then the Africa Development Bank is set to sign off releasing them from the money that's owed to the Africa Development Bank. And this should be happening in Abidjan next week, Monday. So what he said that is really important with regards to this is that, outside of the debt being forgiven and then rebuilding, they obviously want to be able to rebuild their infrastructure, fund education and so forth. They really also feel that the Somalis in the diaspora, specifically those in the United States and in Canada, and in the United States, particularly in Minneapolis area, which is where the actual Somali Congresswoman Ilha Omar is actually based in, she's actually based in that community. He says that they should be playing more of a role in terms of investing back into Somalia if Somalia is going to be able to grow and become all it is that it can be. So he's actually going to be going out to the States, to Minneapolis, to speak to the biggest Somali community out there, just to basically say, look, we're rebuilding, we've been consolidating our debt, but the only way that Somalia is going to grow is if people in the diaspora actually start investing back into Somalia. And just some interesting figures that currently the Somalis living in the diaspora actually contribute $2 billion or 40% of Somalia's gross domestic product in remittances every year. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see if, they can get people to rally behind them. But I think that Somalia looks like they're trying to get on the right path. They've had a really hard time between Al-Shabaab, between, the issues that they've had over the last 2 decades, the pirates and so forth. So let's hope that this will be a story of a country that's able to rebuild themselves.
Most certainly. On to an arts story. It's a big business story too. Nollywood and Bollywood. Well, we're more familiar with Bolly than Nolly, perhaps, but a collaboration that could see Nigeria's film industry, and it's actually very big and very effective, benefiting from a collaboration with Bollywood.
Yeah, definitely. So Nollywood and Bollywood are amongst the largest film industries in the world. Firstly, in terms of the amount of films that they're able to churn out every year. And then secondly, just with regards to their populations and then people actually buying into the films. So whether it's DVD or that sort of thing, they have huge audiences. So this film is called Namaste Wahala, which basically is translated to Hello Trouble. Namaste obviously being from India, and then Wahala is trouble in pidgin English. And it's centered around another really interesting industry in Nigeria and India, which is the wedding industry. And as you know, according to Business Vogue, they said that the Indian wedding industry is said to be valued at about $50 billion, and in Nigeria, a wedding can cost you a sweet $13,000, depending on who you are, of course. And so, what they're hoping will happen is that through this collaboration, they'll be able to open up markets and to increase their market share for Nigerian actors and the Nigerian Nollywood industry in Bollywood and in in India as a whole, and then vice versa with Bollywood within Nigeria. Because once you put those two industries together, financially it's going to make a huge difference. I mean, in Nigeria, Nollywood is said to be one of the highest payers of people, not just in terms of the actors and the actual production managers or people who work on production, but the fringe industries that surround Nollywood as well. So, you know, the film industry has been really instrumental in Nigeria with regard to being able to help employ young people and just, you know, people who perhaps wouldn't have had work before. And in India, I can imagine that the statistics are the same. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that collaboration is a benefit to both industries.
And then finally, I mean, I love this story simply because you would never think it to be true, but the world's first 3D printed resort is in Mozambique.
Yes, it is in Mozambique, and it's actually being developed by a developer who's got a history in luxury brands and had like a private jet company. And so the resort is called Kisawi Resort, and it's on Benguera Island in Mozambique. It's all centered around this 3D sustainable printing construction. But what they've been saying is that yes, it is the first of its kind. But they said that they are, you know, going to be using they have used sand and water with the development of it. What's interesting is what it is that it's going to cost. It's going to cost around 5,000 euros per night, and it's going to be opening the summer of 2020. So it looks like they'll be getting quite a few international guests coming in, because it is a private, it's a private resort, it's a private island, to have all the different amenities and so forth. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that all goes, that all plays out. But I think it's really good to see that Mozambique is leading with regards to this, because when it comes to holidays, Mozambique is, in my opinion, is one of the best places to go.
Stop talking about it, Lee. Don't talk about it. No leave to you. Lee Kasuba, thank you. Lee is the host of Africa State of Mind and tonight's Africa Business Reporter. Fabulous story about the Mozambican 3D printed resort.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Bruce Whitfield on 702.
How It Works, brought to you by My Way. Get an obligation-free business insurance quote from My Way, and you could win a billboard. My Way is a licensed insurer and FSP. T's and C's apply. We told you earlier about how finance ministers from the G7 group of nations have said they'll use all appropriate policy tools to tackle the economic impact of coronavirus. We've seen big global events being cancelled, including a conference in Cape Town. There's been a bunch of stuff cancelled. We also today saw the U.S. Fed announced a surprise 50 basis point rate cut in order to stimulate the U.S. economy in the face of the coronavirus. And it doesn't stop the spread of the disease, but what it does do perhaps is put a little bit of confidence back into a system that is feeling a little bit vulnerable and a little bit threatened. What that has done is caused the rand to strengthen quite nicely this evening. To rand to the pound, it was at 2015 earlier on today, now trading around 1966 to the pound. So there is quite a substantial recovery coming through in the rand. Although markets in the US are not buying the stimulus, we did see after an initial spike upwards, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which gained 5% last night. Let's not forget that. But there was a very, very sharp pullback. But yeah, there have been all of these cancellations of massive events. ITB is one of the tourism industries biggest events. It's been cancelled in Germany. And as you'd hear from this assembly of different global news reports, it's not an isolated incident.
Saudi Arabia has temporarily suspended entry into the country to people who wish to complete pilgrimage to Mecca amid fears over the virus.
At a hotel in Spain's Canary Islands, the doors are chained shut, and nearly 1,000 tourists there have been ordered to stay in their rooms.
Japan shutting down all elementary, middle, and high schools from now until late March in hopes of controlling the outbreak.
I mean, those are the sorts of frenzied responses that we're seeing. Somebody who you may know from social media, somebody you know may know from podcasts, if you're a regular podcast listener, is a guy called Tim Ferriss. In his interviews, all the famous people in the United States, he says, after much thought, I've cancelled my attendance at SXSW, which is South by Southwest. I love South by Southwest, but I don't believe the novel coronavirus can be contained, and I view an international event of 100,000 plus people as a huge risk to attendees and an entire city. Given the limited ICU beds, etc., I employ Mayor Adler, that's the mayor of the city where South by Southwest is going to occur, to stop this event. The world is frightened of coronavirus. Chifiwa Chifangwa is the chief executive at the Tourism Business Council. It represents the interests of business owners in the tourism world. Are they panicking? Are they nervous? Are your members worried?
Thank you, Bruce, and thank you for having me, and good evening to the listeners. Look, the coronavirus is a worry for everyone, you know, across, you know, the globe. And if you look at the, you know, tourism industry, you know, globally, you know, it's a $5.7 trillion industry with 319 million jobs. And that's pretty much one in 10 people are working, you know, in tourism. And the same here in South Africa, where, you know, it represented 2.7 to GDP and about 130, you know, billion, you know, in 2018. So it's a significant industry. You know, are we worried? Yes, we are worried about events that are, you know, that interrupt tourism. But it's the degree of worry, you know, that comes with it. You know, we have many other things in South Africa that are of concern, you know, that crime and many other things that are preventing tourists to come to this country. Coronavirus is very important. It's very scary. We have seen, you know, in the Asia-Pacific region where, you know, many airlines have cancelled, you know, the flights to go to that particular region. Many tourists coming from, China, which is one of the largest, pretty much the largest outbound market by volume and spends a significant amount of money, you know, outbound. So it is a worry for us, but we have to contextualize, you know, the whole, you know, coronavirus in terms of how many people are infected, how many people are, you know, have passed on due to this virus and what were the circumstances and so forth and so on, so that we can operate in a contextualized world and perhaps we don't overreact.
And that is the risk of overreaction that is as big as the risk of underreaction. But what we're seeing is very, very strong attempts by various geographies where there have been these outbreaks of coronavirus to contain it. In some cases, Chinese people have been banned from traveling. In some cases, parts of northern Italy have been shut down and there's strong quarantines in force. But it's a question of perception. And people generally, when they book long-haul destinations like South Africa, they're doing it at least 6 to 12 to 18 months in advance because it's expensive, it's far, it takes a lot of organizing to do because we don't have a particularly well-integrated tourism sector in South Africa where it's easy to get around, easy to do fun stuff. And so we're going to have a lot of people who kind of paid big money to come. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to come anyway. But it's about the people who sort of now suddenly get put off traveling at all, who don't book 6 months, 12 months, 18 months from now. It's almost like having another day zero phenomenon for Cape Town.
Yeah. I mean, look, you're quite right. You know, a lot of people have booked in advance and they are looking forward to their trips. And we are ready and we are open for business, you know, as a tourism industry to welcome those guests that are coming into the country. And we'll make sure that they have the experience that, you know, that's unforgettable and they'll go back and talk about the country. So those that are, you know, that book in a short space of time, you know, of course, this will be a concern for them. But, you know, we have been saying all along that, you know, there is no case reported in South Africa of coronavirus as of today. We follow, you know, what, you know, the Department of Health has been saying in terms of the precaution that needs to be taken. And I think that, you know, so far, you know, we are in a good space as a country. And I think that, you know, we just need to prepare ourselves more to make sure that, you know, if and when, you know, this virus reaches our shores, we are prepared and we're able to respond to it. But from the tourism industry point of view, you know, it is something that, you know, if you look at, you know, things that we do in hotels in terms of hygiene, you know, issues, we are far in advance. And I think as an industry, you know, we are very well prepared. And as a country, you know, we are open for business. We don't want people to cancel their trips
because
of coronavirus. And I think that it's there are a whole lot more people that don't have coronavirus than people that have coronavirus.
The trouble is perceptions become fact. And when caution, when the world turns cautious, and so much of our new market comes from places where infections have been discovered. So we want lots of Chinese tourists. We made it very difficult for Chinese tourists to come. We had bizarre visa regulations where people had to appear on opposite ends of one of the biggest countries in the world personally to apply for visas. We're just getting through that. We're digitizing the visa process. And now this happens. It doesn't rain, but it pours. I mean, just obstacle after obstacle being thrown in the path of an industry, which is just this wonderful jobs multiplier, this wonderful opportunity.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, if you look at the, you know, know, we have about 722,000 people that are employed within the tourism industry. And China is a very important market. When we looked at, you know, our strategy for 2030, you know, we said, you know, some of the growth that we're going to be having is going to be coming from China. And there are a whole lot more people, you know, outbound travel in China reached up around 150 million trips, you know, in 2019. So it is a significant market for growth, and it's somewhere where we're looking at, you know, to boost our numbers and to create more jobs. And I believe that, you know, that, you know, at some point, you know, someone and the clever people in pharmaceuticals will find a way, and the scientists and everybody else who's involved, you know, to have a vaccine for this virus. But at the moment, you know, I think that, you know, for us as a tourism industry, you know, we don't want to, you know, overreact and also underreact. I feel that, you know, we have been preparing ourselves. We have been watching this since December. We have been, you know, getting more information about the virus. And the people that I've spoken to within the industry are quite, you know, confident that, you know, we're moving to the right direction. I have received the briefing from the Department of Health. They have told us, you know, their state of preparedness. And I think that, you know, as an industry, you know, we can't just go and, you know, cancel things, you know, that we've planned, you know, without really looking at the information that's coming in, you know, verifying, you know, the information that's coming in, testing the people that, you know, are suspected, and making sure that as a country, you know, we don't, you know, sort of destroy the business that we have and put the jobs that we have at risk. So there is a lot of balancing act that we are doing. But, you know, we believe that, you know, tourism should continue. And we believe that, you know, there is a whole lot more to benefit. And we just need to be extremely careful, you know, when we, you know, get tourists that are coming to the country, but certainly not canceling people or banning people, you know, from coming to the country. It's not something that we want as a tourism industry.
I mean, one of the great ironies, of course, of a place like South Africa is people are dying of diseases related to immunodeficiency. So HIV positive people get infections all the time and get things like TB. And I mean, the risk of dying of TB in South Africa is considerably higher than of coronavirus. The risk of being you know, killed in a car crash or being murdered as you visit the country are far higher. But suddenly there's a bug and the world goes completely and utterly mad. I want to talk about tourism and the opportunities that it presents, because yes, the world is going to respond the way the world is going to respond. There's very little we can do about that in an environment where there is panic. But tourism is the big opportunity for South Africa. It's fairly inexpensive to set up. You can rely on private sector operators to spend capital if you provide an environment in which they feel confident that if they build a property, if they carve out a piece of bush, whatever it is that they might do in order to create a tourism experience. I mean, you've just got to go to I'm going to have to just apply my mind quickly. You've just got to go to a particular spot to see how much money has been spent, and it's been wonderful. I'll bring you up to speed with that one in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that gives you expert solutions for your transactional banking needs. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Bruce Whitfield on 702.
I had a moment earlier and I couldn't remember the thing that I was so excited about. I did that thing last year. It was fabulous, a wonderful thing. It's a graskop in Mpumalanga, just on the escarpment. And there's one of the campsites where Jock of the Bushveld. It's an old tourist attraction, but it's one of the places where Percy Fitzpatrick camped out with Jock of the Bushveld, part of that whole chain. And then there's lovely adventures happening there. People can do bridge swings, and there's a foofy slide across the valley, and that's exciting. And suddenly there's a lift that goes from the top of the escarpment down into a rainforest. It must be a drop of at least 80, maybe 100 meters. I mean, it's that sort of thing. Chifiwa Chivengwa, the chief executive of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa, that we need more of, because it's just this wonderful innovation that for, you know, a fair amount of money, especially if you're taking a family down, it costs a bit, but it's a couple of hours of really good entertainment, and the walk at the bottom of the valley is really good, identifying plant species and all of that sort of stuff. It's a great tourism experience.
Now, absolutely, Bruce. It is one of those, you know, experiences that are a shining example, you know, of entrepreneurial spirit and also, you know, the tourism BEE, you know, fund, you know, helped to really get that, you know, the gorge, the lift, you know, being built. So it is one of those shining examples. So we need more of those. We need to make sure that, you know, our adventure, you know, tourism is really, you know, marketed. It's really, you know, portrayed in the international market as South Africa is one of those adventure capitals of the world, because we have got so many things, you know, in this country, you know, that many countries would wish to have. And we need to be able, you know, to do those. And also locally, when people are traveling domestically, you know, those are the things to do. And we have always been encouraging people to, you know, travel your own country, especially now when we're talking about issues surrounding, you know, coronavirus. It gives us an opportunity, those that are afraid of going overseas, travel your own country, explore those hidden gems and those areas that you've never been. If you have never been to Eastern Cape, go to Eastern Cape and find out what it's about. Mpumalanga, as you said, new attractions, you know, do adventure stuff, go for a, you know, a walk, climb Table Mountain and go on safari.
No, there is so much on offer, but the trouble is we've made it so difficult for so long for people to come, and especially for families to come. We can go and get into that whole boring visa issue all over again. But it did do some long-term damage to South Africa's credibility as a visitor-friendly destination. We saw some numbers. Last year, there was a small drop-off in the total number of visitors to South Africa from 10.3 down to, I think, 10.2 million, with a big and very audacious goal of growing to 14 million by 2022. It's an SA tourism goal that I saw in their offices today. This needs a lot of investment. It needs a lot of political capital. And we need to be able to give visitors the sort of assurance that they're going to, one, have a great time, be safe while they're having a great time, and that they go away and tell all their friends about it.
No, absolutely, Bruce. And it is a goal that, you know, we are committed to, you know, as a private sector. We need to do more work in terms of, you know, getting tourists to come into our country. Some may say, you know, you're talking in a time where there's crisis, you know, but we need to be able to be resilient as a tourism industry. We need to be able to get, you know, to those markets, you know, that are important to us. If you look at markets like the US, the UK, you know, we are getting around 1% of the outbound market, or even less than 1%, sometimes 0.1% of the outbound market. So we need to do more in those countries to attract, you know, tourists to come here. The good news is that we have done away with the unabridged birth certificates for children that are traveling into the country. It was one of the biggest hindrances that we have seen since 2015. You know, good news is that, you know, now that's behind us. What we need to do now and what we've committed ourselves to do is to make sure that we attract that, you know, family market. And also school groups. There are a lot of school groups in the UK, you know, that will love to come down here, go and play rugby, you know, with other schools here, come with the principal. So we've made that easier for those groups to now consider us. But again, you know, there is competition out there, and we need to be able to be competitive from the price point of view, and also from, you know, safety point of view. We need to make sure that we solve our problem, and that's what we're doing. We've invested a great deal of money, and we're working with the private security, the police, and we're making sure that, you know, we secure those places that we believe are problematic.
Are private sector airlines managing to pick up all of the slack from SAA's failure? I say it's a failure because it has failed. I mean, yes, it still flies, but as of this week, the only direct routes in South Africa, domestic routes, are Joburg, Cape Town. The rest are all gone, and you now require to get a private sector operator if you want to get between cities in South Africa.
Yeah. Look, Bruce, I think SAA is quite important in the, you know, tourism industry, because airlift is important. We need to be able to move tourists that arrive into this country, and also domestic tourists, to the areas where they want to go to. So it's quite important, you know, from that point of view. It is the largest airline, you know, here in South Africa. Now, you know, as a private sector industry, you know, we have been working with SAA. Yeah, this is from the travel agents, you know, point of view, the tour operators point of view. We have met with the business rescue practitioners to understand what their plan is. And of course,
what is their plan? Can you tell us?
No, it's for us was to understand and be assured that, you know, we can continue, you know, to book SAA and support SAA, and that, you know, the bookings that have been made are going to be, you know, processed, and people are going to be able to travel. So that's what we wanted to understand. But from their plan point of view, it is something that, you know, we are not involved in. For us, it's insurance to make sure that we're able to book, you know, those guests. And then from other airlines' point of view, you know, we have other domestic airlines like your Comair is there, your Fly Safair, and many that's your mango, you know, that are, you know, coming in, you know, which we appreciate and filling in the gap and making sure that they can fly to those destinations that SAA is no longer going to be flying. It will make the market more competitive. Mm. We may see, you know, reduction in prices to customers. But for us as a tourism industry, it's to make sure that there is connectivity around the country. People are able to go where they need to go. We have enough, you know, capacity, you know, to carry the tourists around. Because it would be disappointing for international airlines to arrive here with the people, put them at, you know, in Cape Town, put them here in Joburg or Durban, and they're unable to move to other, you know, destinations. That will cause problems.
Absolutely. But what's been so wonderful is to see how British Airways has launched, you know, regular flights directly to Durban. Virgin is coming in for seasonal flights from the September season this year. Mm. Delta launched its direct flights into Cape Town from December last year. Mm. There is a huge amount of appetite. There's a huge amount of interest. And what we're failing to do is to get people back and forth. Well, the market makes a plan.
Absolutely. Look, you know, you have teams that are working around, you know, in terms of air access. There is a, you know, Western Cape air access team that's working around, you know, this is the team that brought in the United flight.
They've been very effective.
They've been very effective. And there will be a team that will be set up here in Gauteng to really look into the issues around air access and bring more airlines, you know, here into Gauteng as well as in Durban. We need to intensify that to make sure that, you know, we have more capacity coming into the country and we have, you know, all these carriers coming from the US, UK, and everywhere else around the world coming into South Africa. I think it's a wonderful initiative that we've done, and we need more of those.
Tufiyo Tubengwa, thank you. The Chief Executive at the Tourism Business Council. Coronavirus is coming. It's like Philip, it's going to be here. And we are just going to have to roll with it, I'm afraid. It's one of those things that we are unlikely to be able to avoid.